All right, well, we are continuing our study of creation evolution. So this is the series that deals with all of the ideas about evolution and their improbability, and the ideas of creation and their plausibility. So today we're looking at the concept of the futile speculations that go into adhering to an evolutionary worldview. So last time we looked at how when you build a structure of life with evolution at the foundation, you do so to keep man at the top of the structure. And the evolutionists would say we believe evolution because we must believe evolution, because that's what we have to believe in order to throw God off of the throne and not be accountable to him. So man will try anything, do anything, and believe anything to keep God out of the picture. So there is no room for God in any of the ideas or theories or concepts that the evolutionist or the culture at large would allow into the discussion, because to begin to contemplate the existence of God would begin to contemplate our responsibility to a creator, and that is out of the question. So God says in Romans 1, 21 and 22, even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God nor give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools. And that is probably one of the greatest, most accurate descriptions of academia that you could ever come up with. Professing, or you could just say professors, thinking they're wise, have become fools because they have adopted these huge jumps in logic and overlooked these mountains of evidence in order to keep God from the consideration. So, in order to get God out of the picture, man has a series of futile speculations that we'll look at tonight to explain how we got here. To begin with, futile speculation number one is the Big Bang. In the beginning, all matter and energy of the universe was in a single spot no bigger than the head of a pin. So that is the idea, that this concentration of matter, time, and energy was all bottled up in this infinitesimal dot that exploded. Now, we don't know where the dot came from. We don't know how long it was there before it exploded. And we don't know why it exploded. So origin unknown, length of existence unknown, and reason unknown for the Big Bang. So this begs a lot of questions on the face, but there's several other things to examine. The debris that was scattered by this explosion supposedly began to form planets, and that idea itself breaks three of the most proven laws of science. To begin with, the law of angular momentum. Have any of you ever had the great joy and privilege of riding on a merry-go-round at supersonic speeds? That is a terrifying experience. But just for the sake of this illustration, let's imagine that we have a young, unfortunate person on a merry-go-round, and the entire football team is spinning it as fast as they can. So eventually, we know that this poor, unfortunate soul is going to have to come off of that because of the force that's generated by that thing going around so fast. The law of angular momentum says that when things are moving in a direction, so when whoever that is finally has to let go, they're going to be going in a circle until they let go, and then they're going to be going in one direction. But what are they going to be doing when they're traveling that direction? They're flying, but they're also spinning because they were spinning when they came off of it. So they're going to keep spinning until they hit a tree or a telephone pole or something. So when you think of angular momentum, that's a law, a proven law of science, that when you come off at an angle, that angular momentum is going to continue to carry you in that manner until you're acted upon by another force. Well, that would make sense if all of the planets in our universe rotated in the same direction. But they don't. There's several planets that operate in a opposite direction to the direction that most of the planets rotate in. So several of those planets are breaking this law of angular momentum, calling the whole theory of the Big Bang into question. Second is the law of diffusion. If you have a jar of water, a glass jar, let's say, so we can get a good view of it, and you have a dropper of food coloring. You drop some food coloring in there. What do you expect to happen? Would that drop just sink to the bottom and boom, boom, boom? What's going to happen? It's going to So if it's red food coloring, now you have red water, or pink water if it's just a few drops. So there's this problem of diffusion, because if something is exploding, then it's going to go in the same amounts in all directions. But we have clusters of stars. So they didn't diffuse throughout the universe. And the most obvious objection to the Big Bang is the law, or the second law of thermodynamics, which is the law that states that everything is going from a state of order to a state of disorder. So in the theory of the Big Bang, we have a massive amount of disorder that comes into this synchronistic, whatever that word is, the synchronism of the planets and stars going around in perfect harmony, the ballet of astronomy, and you just wonder, well, how did that happen out of an explosion? How do we have an organized universe that goes like clockwork, literally, with no intentionality behind that? So evolutionists are willing to disregard one of the most proven laws of science in order to remove God from the picture. And the second law of thermodynamics is readily observable anywhere you look. It doesn't matter where you look, you find things going from a state of order to disorder. For example, if you have a home that you build, it's out in the woods, and it's you make it just like you want it, it's perfect, and you go away for 50 years. What's going to happen when you come back? Is it going to be bigger and better than when you left it? No. It's going to have deteriorated. It's going from a state of order to a state of disorder. That is observable everywhere in the universe. And yet we think that because the Big Bang requires it, that everything went from a state of chaos to a state of impeccable order. The Big Bang would be a futile speculation, having to believe evolution because mankind must believe evolution. Futile speculation number two would be an old Earth. So at best calculation, the Bible indicates that the Earth is approximately 6,000 to 10,000 years old. And that's based upon the chronology that you find from Adam all the way to Christ. So that gives us an idea about a biblical account of the age of the Earth. There's really a lot of scientific proof for a young Earth. When you look at and we looked at this in one of the other lessons, when you look at Adam through Noah, the dates are pretty well preserved for us, so that we have a number to come up with, because we know when Christ was born, and we can go from creation to Christ pretty well chronologically through Scripture. So the old Earth, scientists believe it is about 13.82 billion years old. That's not an M, that's a B. So that is a whole lot of time. And they arrive at that date, not based on any evidence necessarily, but because that's how long they believe evolution would take to have occurred. So you can't get to the state of order that we have and the complexity that we have in the time that doesn't include billions and billions and billions of years. So this old Earth has a lot of problems with it. There is evidence from the decay of the Earth's magnetic field that shows that the Earth could not be more than 15,000 years old. Because of the rate at which it's decaying, it would not be able to have started any farther back than that. Physicists state that the amount of helium in the atmosphere should be thousands of times greater. Atmospheric helium indicates that the Earth is no more than 15,000 years old. So atmospheric helium, is, we're losing helium into into space on at a regular basis. And based upon the amount of helium that we have, it doesn't support millions of years of the Earth's existence. The moon is slowly moving away from the Earth. It is measurably moving away from the Earth. So at the present rate of movement, the Earth and the moon would have been touching just 2 million years ago. And that's one of the ground level assumptions of evolution, is that all of the processes that are going on in the world today have always worked that way at the same rate. So if that's true, then the Earth can't be any more than 2 million years old. And yet the universe is supposed to be 13 billion years old. So this is what the Bible teaches about our Earth's history. About 6,000 years ago, there is this incredible event called creation, where God spoke the world into existence. About 4,000 years ago, there is another incredible event where God, because of the wickedness of mankind, has Noah to build an ark, and he completely rearranges the entire topography of the earth in 1 year's period. And from that time on, there's a radically different environment, a radically different place for mankind to dwell. And then on about 2,000 years ago, we have Christ, another incredible event in the earth's history, who comes in the form of man to be the sacrifice for mankind. And then we travel on to today. So that's a general timeline for a biblical understanding of the earth and its experiences. The third speculation is called a spark of life. So just as a way of illustration, this is a stained glass window. It's just a picture of it. But the stained glass window is in England, and it's in this magnificent church, and it is absolutely huge. It is enormous. And in looking at that, you kind of have to come to the conclusion that that wasn't because of a windstorm. That wasn't because of an explosion. That was because somebody wanted to do something very specific, and they planned it out, and they had to do just years and years of work to make that such an intricate creation. Well, compare that to this structure. That doesn't look accidental, does it? Oh, somebody intended to do that. And that person was God. Because what you're seeing is a DNA strand seen from one end to the other. You know, you usually see it from the side with the spiral staircase look. Well, that's what it looks like looking through top to bottom. So if in one case you have this incredibly ornate structure that you have to assume was a direct result of intention and effort and love, then why would we think that DNA was just a random happenstance that just happened by accident? There's a video out when you get hooked up with Faith Life. There's something attached to your Faith Life account called Faith Life TV, and on that app or on that section of your account, there's a movie by Ray Comfort called The Atheist Delusion. And I would really encourage you to take a look at that, because he does such a fantastic job. And he deals with this idea of DNA, and he looks at it a little bit differently than this, but very similarly. He says if you were to come across a book lying in the street with page numbers and pictures and a logical, coherent story, would you think that just fell out of the sky? That all of those elements just kind of fell together in that order? Well, many evolutionists speak of DNA as the operating manual for life, the instruction book for life. So if DNA is a code, it is actual information that is put in, like everything about us is determined by our DNA, hair color, eye color, height, everything. If that is accidental, that's like believing that a book with page numbers and pictures and stories all in logical order just happened on accident. No printer necessary. It just fell out of the sky. No, that can't happen. When you have a incredibly intricate design and a purposeful design, you have to come to the conclusion that there is a designer, because nothing in our experience, nothing in our universe happens accidentally. Order does not come from chaos. Futile speculation number four, mistakes are good. So scientists believe that mutations cause life to evolve upward. So really the only mechanism they have for an amoeba to transform itself into a human over millions of years, molecules to man, is that there must have been changes in the DNA of all those organisms that just kind of shifted and changed and mutated over time, allowing them to evolve, capital E, upwards, to advance. Well, there's a problem. Mutations are mistakes that are made when DNA copies itself. It is an actual loss of information, not an addition of information. So in something as important as DNA, do you think a mistake would be good? I mean, in the comic book world, we have mutants that are these superheroes. Works good with the evolutionary theory, but it doesn't work good with science. Because when you mutate things, you don't benefit whatever you mutated. Whenever there's mutations in a organism, for instance, they've been able to genetically modify fruit flies so that they have six wings. Just one problem. They can't fly. So when you have these mutations that are supposedly going on all around us all the time, developing all of life upwards, you're overlooking the fact that the only mechanism to do that is mutation, which is a loss of information, not an addition of information, which makes the upward evolution of any creature seem absurd. So mutations occur once at every, that's a lot of zeros. How many, what is that number? 10 trillion. Okay, that's not a lot of mutations that happen. So God did a pretty good job when he did that whole DNA thing. The chance of two related mutations occurring is one in more than a trillion. And the chance of four related mutations is one in 100. And we're talking about a whole lot more than four to allow something to mutate from one thing into another thing. All of those mutations have to be beneficial, because if you mutate the wrong thing, the thing ceases to exist. So to evolve a horse by mutations would take several thousand related mutations. That results in a number too large to even fit on the screen. So there's a problem with the spark of life. There's a problem with how we can get something from molecules to man. The mechanism doesn't work. It's not feasible. That leads to the fifth futile speculation. It's called the hopeful monster theory. Stephen Jay Gould, evolutionist of Harvard, realized the statistical problem of slow mutations causing big E evolution. He recognized that that is just way too improbable. Like the statistically, in mathematics, there's a statistical limit before it just becomes absurd and you don't even consider it anymore. Well, that way outweighs the mathematical absurdity level for statistical analysis. So he proposed the idea called punctuated equilibrium, and he nicknamed it the hopeful monster theory. And it kind of goes like this. So Mr. and Mrs. Geico Gecko, they meet up with each other and they have a baby gecko. And that is to be expected. You have generation number two, where you have that baby gecko meets another girl gecko, and they end up making a family with another gecko involved. Then generation number three, you have one of those offspring finding another mate. Another gecko is involved. And obviously the next step is that they have a bird as an offspring. So they just jumped over all of these necessary things. It just popped out a bird instead of a lizard. That's the kind of thinking that it takes to make up for the lack of information that's necessary to evolve from one kind into another kind, because it's just too statistically improbable for related mutations to benefit a organism into upward mobility in the evolutionary chain. What does God say? Even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations. Their foolish heart was darkened, and professing to be wise, they became fools. Man would say, we believe evolution because we must believe evolution, because the alternative is to be accountable to a holy God. Man will, as we said, try, do, and believe anything to keep God out of the picture. Futile speculation number six, the six great assumptions. The first great assumption is that non-living material gave rise to living material. There is no explanation for where life originated. We have the Big Bang as the explanation for how the universe got here, but when it comes to how life came to be on Earth, it had to have come from non-living material. We have to believe that this happened only once, because we never see life just spontaneously erupting on the scene. It hasn't happened anywhere else in the universe that we've become aware of. So that happened only once, which means that all forms of life, from bacteria to you, are related. We're related to the dogs and the mice and the fleas and everything else you can think of. Single cell life, capital E, evolved into multiple celled life. Creatures without backbones, capital evolved into creatures with backbones. And that seems like an incredibly complex accomplishment, to go from an invertebrate to a vertebrate. Fish became amphibians, amphibians became reptiles, reptiles became birds and mammals. Species evolved into other species. And these are assumptions, and what that means is they're taken for granted. You believe these things to be true from the outset without needing proof for them, because they can't be proven. So these six assumptions are something they don't need to prove, because they're at the bedrock, the foundation of the theory of evolution. They have to believe these things because that's the foundation for the theory itself. Seventh speculation is the ascent of man, and you've seen the little picture in the textbooks of the little pygmy monkey that just kind of makes his way up into the upward walking proud man. And I like the picture underneath of it, because in geek speak, when there's a picture missing, there's a little icon down there, and it means missing link. There's not a link to that picture, and it's a missing... Never mind. So the ascent of man is this idea that we started with these little tiny monkeys, and we have gone on up through the evolutionary chain to arrive at the latest, greatest iteration in mankind. So the first proof that they have of this ascent of man is a fossil called Ramapithecus. It's a U-shaped jaw, supposedly indicating human ancestry. The jaw was found in two pieces and was pieced together. In fact, Ramapithecus is a pygmy chimp and not a human ancestor. This is one of the most famous of the proofs of evolution that you'll find in textbooks, and that is the fossil called Lucy. It's called Australopithecus, and the reason why it's called Lucy is because they were doing this dig around 1971, somewhere in there, and in this archaeological or this dig they were doing to find fossils, when they found this fossil, the Beatles song Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds was playing. So she ended up being called Lucy. This is the most complete skeleton of a so-called human ancestor that we have on record. Only the knee indicates her humanity. Ironically, the knee was found a mile and a half away and 300 feet deeper than the rest of the skeleton. So it kind of calls into question whether this was the kneecap of Lucy or not. And if it wasn't, is it possible that Lucy was just a monkey? Homo habilis, that is another proof of evolution that is disregarded by most scientists today as merely an orangutan. There is Cyanthropus, or commonly called Peking man. The real bones of this proof of evolution have disappeared. It was found in the upper caves in Peking, China, and there were evidences of fire and tools that were around the skeleton or the bones that they found in the cave. It was believed to be an ape-like animal using tools and fire. Might have been another explanation for that, instead of some pre-human ancestor. Pithecanthropus, or Java man. In this example, the femur appears to be human. The skull cap appears to be from an ape, but they were found 46 feet away from each other. And later, it was rejected by its founder as separate bones. He didn't end up believing in the end that it was an actual of the same organism. Eanthropus, or Piltdown man. This has been dismissed for years as a fraud. The teeth have been filed down, and the bones were treated to give it the appearance of age. So if something is absolutely true and has all the evidence that is necessary to support it, why would there be people that are making fraudulent proof of something that should be readily available anywhere you look? Unfortunately, it's very hard to find the real thing when it's the missing link for a reason. Hesperanthropus, or so-called Nebraska man. This picture that you see appeared in the newspaper in the 1920s. This is a picture that was drawn from one tooth that was found. So this is an incredibly accurate drawing, you can imagine. This was used as evidence for evolution in the Scopes monkey trial. That was the trial that was a big decision-making factor for our country about allowing evolution to be taught in our schools. The rest of the jaw was found several years later, and it was found to be the jaw and tooth of a pig and not of an ancient ancestor. Eoanthropus, or Piltdown man, that was the sculpture produced from the previous jawbone. So amazing what they can find from just a little bit of information. You can get a lot of detail out of that when you're really using your imagination. Neanderthal man is normal except for stooped posture. His bones are similar to the modern European. It was later discovered that Neanderthal man suffered from rickets, which would have altered his bone shape. So there are many times living fossils that we find. In order to get God out of the picture, man has a series of futile explanations that explain how we got here. Rather than actually having proof, they come up with these wild ideas of how it must have happened, because it had to have happened, because we can't allow God to be in control. Again, man will try, do, and believe anything to keep God out of the picture. John chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. The Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being by Him. Apart from Him, nothing came into being that has come into being. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men. So we don't need all of these gyrations and imaginations of what must have happened for us to have come from a little ooze pool in the distant past to have come crawled out and to become what we are. God created us the way we are from the beginning, and we are actually a whole lot worse off now than we were when God created Adam. Scientists actually believe that we use about 10% of our actual brain capacity in the modern human being. So you can imagine Adam was firing on all 12 cylinders and we're just on a little 3-cylinder maybe. So the devolution of mankind is something that is well underway. Anything you would add to our discussion?
Yeah.
Well, they have a whole lot of presuppositions that they, things that they assume to be true beforehand that are unsustainable.
And they
still try to teach some of that stuff, and it's ridiculous. Oh, yeah. It's a foregone conclusion. They don't even teach it much anymore. They just assume that everybody's smart enough to know that we came from a little puddle somewhere. Yes? I know that they've kind of gone away from the carbon dating. That's lost a lot of favor. But even radioisotope dating has come under a lot of criticism. And I would direct you to the Answers in Genesis website, because they have PhDs and stuff that can explain all of that, and they have papers and you know, scholarly work that really calls into question how well we can trust all of these dating methods that come up with billions and millions of years. For instance, the one specimen that they found, it was an early rhinoceros, and they sent one sample from the front side of the rhinoceros to one lab, and they sent another specimen to another lab, and they came back with dates that were millions of years apart. So if they're really accurate dating methods, why wouldn't they have come back with a at least closer than a million years apart? I mean, did that half of it wait around for a million years to decay before it decided to become a fossil? So there's really some hard questions about the accuracy of those dating methods.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the dirty little secret of the whole dating scenario, where you're dating fossils and all, is that what they do is they find a fossil, and they know exactly what layer of strata they found it in, and they know in their framework of history what age that fossil should be based upon the layer it's in, and then they just keep testing it, and anything that doesn't match where that strata, they toss it out, and then when they get something close, they go, oh, look how old it is. Yep, that matches. That's they don't advertise that, but that's the game of how you get everything to match up and work well.
So would you consider the Earth as an organism?
No, I think the idea of Mother Earth and Earth as an organism is an idea that has its roots in evolution, because an evolutionary thought, Earth is what we need to preserve, and mankind is a parasite on Earth, and mankind needs to be managed so that we don't use up all the resources on this wonderful blue ball that we're floating on. That's the opposite of the biblical worldview. God created the Earth and told mankind to subdue it, to care for it, to be in control of the Earth. So that's a completely opposite world from the biblical viewpoint.
But all life starts with water. That's what sounds.
And
how would an explosion?
Yeah, I don't know how an explosion would create water. That's a good question. Well, I would... We talked last time about the video series Creatures That Defy Evolution, and I did look for it, and it's on Right Now Media. So if you have a Right Now Media account, you can go on and watch those. But as I was looking for it, I found that it's only there until October 1st. It gets taken off of that platform. So you got a little window to go watch those, and then you'll have to find it somewhere else. But I know it's free for you if you have a Right Now Media account to watch. Anything else before we close? All right, let's pray. Lord, thank you for our time tonight. Thank you for the opportunity to look into your word and into your world and see your hand involved in both. And I pray that you give us your wisdom and your grace as we go. Help us to see the importance of looking at the world through your eyes, and help us to see the necessity of a biblical worldview. And I pray that we would not be intimidated into just walking away from a conversation, but help us to be equipped to consider, to discuss, and to contend for a biblical view of creation. Lord, we believe that you have all things well in hand, and we put our lives into your hands, and we look forward to what you're going to do with them. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, thank you very much.